Don't be afraid of the dark. Just relax and let the darkness fall over you.
Welcome to Afraidish, a weekly podcast where each month we venture into a new state and take a deep dive into the paranormal and unexplained while enjoying some tasty adult beverages. From ghost sightings to hauntings, urban legends and cryptids, let's get weird and afraidish together. Hello and welcome to episode 5, take 2.
yeah.
We tried to record, we recorded last night, but my dumb ass tried to edit it and somehow deleted it and couldn't retrieve it, so.
You know what? Shit happens.
Yeah. Anyways, I hope everybody's enjoying our episodes so far, and hopefully they get better and better.
Yeah.
And today, I'm drinking something called Flynn's Irish Red by Public House Brewing Company from St. James, Missouri. And it's pretty good.
And I am drinking water.
All right. And let's get started on my first story. Well, my only story. I have one story, and Ashley has.
I also have one story.
And we're in Tennessee this month. So our first story in Tennessee is about the Bell Witch. Here's a little history of the Bell family. In 1750, John Bell was born in Halifax County, North Carolina, to William Bell and Anne Jones. In 1782, John Bell married Lucy Williams, daughter of prominent farmer John Williams of Edgecombe County, North Carolina. The Bells bought a farm in Edgecombe County and began amassing wealth and influence in the area. In 1804, the family consisting of John and Lucy Bell and their children Jesse, John Jr., Drury, Benjamin, Esther, Zadok, Elizabeth, aka Betsy, aka John's favorite daughter, Richard Williams, and Joel Egbert, built a house and started a farm on 1,000 acres, located on Red River in Robertson County, Tennessee. Okay, so this doesn't matter, but several sites say they lived on different size acreage of land. These sites vary from 230 acres to 1,000 acres. So I'm going to say it was around 300 acres since most of the sites said it was around that.
Okay.
Of their children, Benjamin died as a young child. Zadok became a prominent lawyer and moved to Mississippi, where he also died relatively young. Esther married Bennett Porter in 1817. Jesse married Martha Gunn, a daughter of Reverend Thomas Gunn, and later moved to Mississippi. John Bell Jr. married Elizabeth Gunn, also daughter of Reverend Thomas Gunn, and became a successful farmer in Robertson County. Drury never married and owned a farm on the north side of the Red River. Elizabeth, or Betsy Bell, eventually married her former teacher, Richard Powell, and moved to Mississippi. Richard Williams Bell was married 3 times to Sally Gunn, another daughter of Reverend Thomas Gunn. So many daughters. Susan Gunn, daughter of Reverend James Gunn. I'm going to guess it's the brother of Thomas Gunn. And Eliza Orndorff. He lived out his life in Robertson County.
Okay.
The youngest child, Joel Egbert, married twice and moved to Springfield, Tennessee, where he became a successful farmer and well-respected citizen. Joel would also become good friends with Martin Van Buren Ingram, who would later write the fictitious book Authenticated History of the Bell Witch, and Joel would undoubtedly give Martin much insight into the mystery. And now for the mysterious happenings.
The good stuff.
The good stuff. The origin of the legendary Bell Witch is, of course, a mystery. Yeah. In early accounts, the spirit itself provides its origin, stating, "I am a spirit. I once was very happy, but I have been disturbed and made unhappy. I am the spirit of a person who was buried in the woods nearby, and the grave was disturbed. My bones disinterred and scattered, and one of my teeth was lost under this house. I am here looking for that tooth. Of course, this cannot be verified. However, a number of Indian burial mounds could be found in the region.
Okay.
In another event, the witch claimed to be, quote, a spirit from everywhere, heaven, hell, the earth, and in the air, the houses, any place at any time, have been created millions of years. And this sounds to me to be like a demon or something of that nature.
Or just a ghost trying to flex.
Yeah, crazy ghost.
Sounds like me when I'm talking to the kids.
Yeah. One day in 1817, John Bell was inspecting his cornfield when he encountered a strange-looking animal sitting in the middle of a cornrow. It had the body of a dog and the head of a rabbit. Shocked by the appearance of this animal, Bell shot several times, but the animal vanished.
Hmm.
This was the first documented manifestation of the entity. Bell thought nothing more of the incident, at least not until after dinner.
Hmm.
That evening, the family began hearing beating sounds on the outside walls of their log home. The mysterious sounds continued with increased frequency and force each night. Bell and his sons often hurried outside to catch the culprit, but always returned empty-handed. One of the sons, Drury, approached an unknown bird perched on a fence that flew off and was of, quote, extraordinary size. So that must have been a huge bird.
Sounds like a big-ass bird.
Yeah.
The daughter, Betsy, observed a girl in a green dress swinging from the limb of an oak tree.
A green dress?
Yeah, a green dress.
That's an unusual color when people are recounting seeing apparitions. They don't normally appear in green dresses. Yeah. It's usually white or black or...
Yeah. In the weeks that followed, Betsy, Drury, and John began to hear unaccounted for knocking on the door and windows. The sound of wings flapping against the ceiling and the sound of rats gnawing on bedposts.
Ew.
More disturbingly, the sound of choking and strangling could be heard along with chains dragging and heavy objects hitting the floor.
Oh.
Sounds emanating from the bedroom as if beds were suddenly and roughly pulled apart, to which was added the sound of fighting dogs chained together, making the noise deafening.
Wow.
In all cases, the source of the noise was never found. No rats were found in the home despite the thorough searching, and no damage to the furniture was ever discovered.
Huh.
During these happenings, the family refused to speak of the events to their neighbors.
Shame or...
Probably. There were probably people who never talked about, like, spiritual stuff like that. I mean, there were, I'm guessing, Christians and...
Right.
The spirit increased its activity, sometimes physically abusing the members of the family. Joel, Richard, Williams, and especially Betsy were subjected to being struck, pinched, and having their hair pulled relentlessly by the Bell Witch.
Ugh.
Yeah. Lucy Bell, the mom, and John Jr. were left relatively unharmed by the witch. Lucy was proclaimed by the spirit to be the, quote, most perfect woman living, and the witch showed a great deal of compassion toward her, even caring for her and singing to her while she was ill.
Ugh.
It's crazy. John Jr. had long, intense conversations with the witch, but he never failed to show his animosity for it, declaring it to be the spirit of the damned.
Huh.
On one famous occasion, the witch recited perfectly the sermon of Reverend James Gunn of Bethel Methodist Church, followed by the sermon of Sugg Fort, despite the fact they had originally been given at the same time, more than 12 miles apart.
Interesting.
That's crazy. Family friend William Porter claimed the witch climbed in bed with him, allowing him the opportunity to seize the spirit in the bedclothes and attempting to throw it into the fire, saying only the immense weight and terrible smell of it prevented him from succeeding. That is crazy. The witch had a dislike for the family's slaves, tormenting them relentlessly, beating them, and refusing to allow them into the house.
Aww.
A Bell slave named Dean stated he encountered the witch several times and that it appeared frequently in the form of a large black dog or wolf, sometimes with two heads, sometimes with no head.
Ugh.
That's creepy.
Yeah.
He carried with him at all times his axe and a, quote, witch ball made by his wife as protection from the witch's influence.
Okay.
visitors and neighbors were not immune from the witch's performance either. In one instance, the witch set three dogs named Caesar, Tige, and Boulder on traveling shakers who never traveled by the farm again.
Oh.
In another, neighbor and husband of Esther Bell, Bennett Porter, fired a shot at a knotty log that had been conjured up by the upon by the witch. She struck the bark and cut it in two.
Nope. A knotty log.
Yes.
Knotty or knotty?
Knotty as in it had lots of knots in it.
It wasn't behaving mischievously.
No.
What an interesting apparition to shoot at. A log.
I know.
A knotty log appeared.
Yeah, so I'm going to shoot it. She struck the bark and cut into it, but the conjuration vanished. Only the bent tree and bullet hole remained. That's crazy. In another instance, Dr. Mize, a noted conjurer from Simpson, Kentucky, came to exorcise the witch and was mocked and frightened away.
Aww.
John Bell Sr. and Betsy Bell seem to be the two most frequently abused by the witch. For reasons still unclear, the witch adamantly opposed the union of childhood sweethearts Betsy Bell and Joshua Gardner, frequently resorting to ruthless taunts and physical abuse.
Jealous much?
Lots jealous. The witch's attacks on Betsy were not all related to her relationship with Gardner, and the constant threat of the witch began to affect her such that she became prone to fainting spells and smothering sensations, often appearing exhausted and lifeless. Her experiences were not confined to the Bell property either. Betsy later described one incident. When the spirit became so tantalizing, filling my mind with horror and causing me to become so nervous, my parents often sent me to a neighbor's to rest for a night. My first night away from home was spent with Theny Thorne.
Theny Thorne.
Yeah. When we retired, there came a loud knocking on our outside door, which seemed to fly open, and a great gust of wind was felt. Theny sprang up at once and lit a candle. To our surprise, the door was not open.
Huh.
Then a voice spoke softly. Bessie, you should not have come over here. You know I can follow you anywhere. Now get a good night's sleep. That's creepy.
Yeah.
A soft hand patted my cheek, and the voice again assured us that we would not be disturbed anymore that night.
Yeah.
The rest of the family often attempted to give Betsy relief, and family friend Frank Miles promised to protect Betsy from any further abuse by the spirit. Betsy said, Frank was the most powerful man any of us ever saw, and just as fearless as any living man. One time, he said to me, come sit by me, little sister. Nothing will bother you while I am here.
But? But?
But what?
I don't know.
The witch responded, you go home. You can do no good here. The witch then began abusing Betsy, slapping her, pulling her hair, before turning on Miles, knocking him over and enraging him. Betsy continued to endure the spirit's abuse, and after calling off the marriage to Gardner, Betsy was eventually courted by and married to her former schoolteacher, Richard Powell. Despite the apparent abatement of the witch's torments, in 1820, she left the area with her husband and settled in Mississippi.
Yeah.
John Bell Jr., along with his brothers Drury Bell and Jesse Bell, had fought under General Jackson in the Battle of New Orleans.
Okay.
A few years later, in 1819, Jackson heard about the disturbances at the Bell home and decided to pay a visit and investigate. Jackson owned property on the Red River and desired to visit the Bell farm after hearing the stories.
Mm.
One of his wagons became stuck by an unseen force and could not be moved, despite whipping the horses, examining the wheels, and having it pushed by the men in his party.
Oh.
He exclaimed, by the eternal, boys, this is the witch. To which the witch replied, all right, General, let the wagon move on. I will see you again tonight.
Wow.
The wagon started of its own accord, and they continued on their journey. That evening at camp, a self-proclaimed witch layer or witch hunter said he had a silver bullet and regaled the men with tales of hunting witches. Jackson whispered to a colleague, I'll bet this fellow is an arrant coward. By the eternals, I do wish the thing would come. I want to see him run. After which silence followed. Suddenly, there was the sound of light footsteps prancing on the floor, and the voice stated, "All right, General, I am on hand and ready for business." The witch bade the witch hunter to shoot, but the gun did not fire. The hunter was struck by an unseen force, claimed to feel the pain of being stuck by needles, exclaimed he had been grabbed by the nose, and fled from the tent.
The witch slayer is not so big and bad now.
Yeah. The witch exclaimed, "How the devil did run and beg? I'll bet he won't come through here again and his old horse pistol to shoot me. I guess that's fun enough for tonight, General, and you go to bed now. I will come tomorrow night and show you another rascal in this crowd." Jackson was eager to stay, but his party had enough, and Jackson returned to Nashville shortly thereafter.
Okay.
One of the central goals of the Bell Witch seemed to be the death of John Bell Sr. Old Jack Bell, as the spirit called him, was blasted with curses, heinous threats, and serious physical torments. As the abuse continued to impact his psyche, Bell took to his bed and was cared for by John Jr. On December 19th, 1820, John Bell failed to leave his bed, and John Jr. went to the cupboard to retrieve the medicine for his care. Instead of the three medicine vials, he found only one vial. It was one-third full of a dark, smoky liquid of unknown origin. The voice of the witch gloated, "It's useless for you to try to relieve old Jack. I have got him this time. He will never get up from that bed again." She claimed of the vial that she gave old Jack a big dose of last night while he was fast asleep, which fixed him. The contents of the vial were thrown into the fire and erupted into a blue blaze.
Wow.
In another account, I read he gave a drop to a cat and the cat died instantly.
Hey.
That's crazy. John Bell died December 20th, 1820. The Bell Witch crashed the funeral, disrupting the service and singing body drinking songs.
Rude.
That's crazy. Mary Catherine or Kate. Nope. Rewind. So who do we think? God damn it. So who do we think the witch was? Mary Catherine or Kate Batts, the wife of Frederick Batts, was believed by many to have been the culprit behind the disturbances known as the Bell Witch. Although not a poor woman, she was often mocked by the others throughout the Red River settlement in Robertson County. Her improper usage of words, along with her sometimes strange ways, led many to think she was practicing black magic or other forms of the occult.
Interesting.
In the early years of the century, Benjamin Batts, the brother of Frederick Batts, had a dispute with John Bell over the sale of a slave. Facts of the dispute were later tangled and became the source of a rumor to the effect that John Bell and Kate Batts had the quarrel, and that the Bell Witch was created by Kate Batts to get revenge on Bell. While there are plenty of stories connecting the Bell Witch to Kate Batts and some sort of disagreement that existed between her and John Bell, recent evidence suggests that she had nothing to do with it.
What evidence?
In fact, contrary to reports of her claiming that she would get even with John Bell on her deathbed, Kate Batts actually outlived John Bell by many years.
So she couldn't be the Bell Witch because she didn't die before him?
I guess not. Unless she did practice black magic or something like that.
Black magic.
Today there are many descendants of the Batts family living in Cheatham, Montgomery, and Robertson County. Following the death of John Bell, the witch's activity dropped off sharply. The spirit was still active through the winter and spring of 1821, but it soon bade the family farewell, telling them it would be gone for 7 years.
7 years?
7 years. True to its word, the family remaining on the property, Lucy Richard Williams and Joel, claimed the witch did return in February 1828, reappearing in much the same way it appeared the first time, with shaking beds and unexplained noises.
Huh.
And it soon vanished again, claiming it would return to haunt the Bell descendants once again in 1935, but no other specific hauntings of the Bell family or their property on the level experienced in the early 19th century have been reported.
So I actually looked at the Google Maps over the Bell Witch. It's like a park. And there's like three churches just near the entrance, like on the road that leads you to the park. There's three churches that you drive past.
That is crazy.
Yeah. It's like they're all named Bell something, like Bell Methodist Church or Bell Baptist Church. So they're like totally capitalizing on this Bell Witch ghost business. It's kind of funny.
Yeah. Despite this, unexplained activity in and around the Bell Farm in Adams, Tennessee continues. Various encounters near the property along the old Nashville-Clarksville Road and in the famous Bellwitch Cave still draws tourists and ghost hunters in Adams. The Bellwitch has been the subject of countless modern books, analyses, documentaries, and movies, including the 2006 wide-release motion picture An American Haunting, very loosely based on the Bellwitch legend. And also, I read that the Blair Witch Project was loosely based on the Bellwitch as well.
Interesting.
Which I would like to watch again.
Yeah, I've never watched it.
Though it played a relatively minor role in the original Bellwitch legend of the early 19th century, the cave on John Bell's property has since become a focal point for visitors hoping to experience a bit of the haunting themselves.
Interesting.
Added to the National Historic Registry in 2008, the cave is the only original feature from the legend that can still be seen today, largely unchanged from the way the Bell family would have seen it in 1817.
Wow.
Though numerous eerie events have been reported by visitors to the cave, including the renowned difficulty in taking photographs around the site in the pre-digital age, nothing on the scale of the original haunting centered around the Bell House, long since torn down, has been reported since the early 1800s.
Wow.
And that's the story of the Bell Witch.
Interesting. I've heard this legend before, watching like Ghost Adventures or whatever, but they never really delve into the history of the lore of it. My question is, where are all these documents? Like, these are real documents.
Right.
That diaries and things?
Just, like, hand-me-down legends from people who've actually experienced it. Like, telling their families and friends and...
So this quite possibly never actually happened.
I mean, it's just a legend, I guess.
Right. Like, there's no written documentation.
I mean, there's books been written, like, just shortly after. Like I said, the youngest son was friends with the guy that wrote a book about it.
Okay. And supposedly a president. What was it, Andrew Jackson?
Yes. He experienced the whole thing.
And there's documentation of Andrew Jackson speaking about this encounter?
I'm guessing, since several people witnessed him saying that. And
you're guessing? You did all the research and you're guessing?
I didn't research that part. Sorry.
I just, because, like, in my head, like, knowing what I know about spirit interactions and things like that, and, like, how witchcraft actually works, the only way that this is possible is if the family was faking it, or if this is just some legend, some folk tale that never really happened. Some bored people were sitting around a campfire near a cave and started telling stories of a bell witch that haunted a family that never actually existed. Like, you know where I'm going with this?
Yeah.
These people existed.
Yes.
For real.
For real.
Okay. And there is or is not or may not be documentation outside of word of mouth passing these stories down through the generations.
I guess there is. I didn't search that much. I've been busy.
Okay. I'm just like, the analytical part of my brain is kicking in and I'm like, there's no way.
It's just a story. Don't think too much of it.
Well, do you even know me?
Yeah.
I think too much about everything.
Yeah, I know.
All right, well, now that I've thoroughly grilled you, you're well done.
Yeah.
We will move on from the Bell Witch to my story. Now, this story I'm very excited about because I've actually been to this location twice now. So this is Carnton Plantation in Franklin, Tennessee. It's about a 15-minute drive just south of Nashville, Tennessee. And it's a really beautiful property. Definitely has the energy of a place where history happened. Some places, you know, that either a lot of history over a long period of time took place there, or there was, you know, big massive events. And this is definitely one of those places that was both a long time to build up the history and then a big event happened. So the home was built in 1826 by Randall McGavick. The house was built, of course, using slave labor. It is constructed mostly from bricks. Estimates say that the exterior walls are about 3 bricks thick, while the interior walls are 2 bricks thick. So that is a sturdy, expensive home. This was like the luxury home of the time. These people were millionaires. Randall McGavick was a pretty prominent politician in the Nashville, Tennessee area. He served a 1-year term as mayor of Nashville in 1824. He rubbed elbows with presidents. President James Polk was an acquaintance, and then President Andrew Jackson was a frequent dinner guest at Carnton Plantation. There is actually a rocking chair on the property that was given to Randall McGavick by President Andrew Jackson. So that's really cool.
That's awesome.
Yeah, can you imagine sitting at a dinner party and, oh, look over there, Beauregard. That rocking chair over there was given to me by the president. Randall McGavick named the property Carnton after his father's birthplace in County Antrim, Ireland. A cairn is the Gaelic word for a pile of stones. And that might sound kind of funny, like, oh, pile of stones, you named your house after rocks. But cairns historically were used for many purposes over the years. They would have been used as markers to mark an important place, or as a monument, or even just as like a navigational system. Just follow the cairns, follow the pile of stones. So it's entirely possible that he had a reason, but also I might be giving this really rich white dude too much benefit of the doubt. The house is built in the federal construction style, which was very popular at the time. The United States was a baby country, so of course everyone was doing it in the federal style. The front elevation of the house is a 2-story house with a side gable roof and a 2-story portico. The back of the house is also 2 stories and has a 2-story full covered porch that spans the entire length of the house and then some. There's some overhang on the east side of the house heading towards the vegetable garden. Speaking of the gardens, the gardens at Carnton Plantation were restored in the 90s to what they would guess would be similar to how the gardens would have been laid out during the McGavick's time on the property. Pretty formal. There is a beautiful covered pathway where they've got like a pergola built over a path, and they've got grapevines growing over the pergola. Hashtag dream. I want grapevines so bad. And then there's a vegetable garden section where they would have grown their fruits and vegetables, and it's kind of set out in a square pattern, and then paths walking between the 4 quarters, and then there's like a circular bed in the middle. The gardens at Carnton Plantation also boast the largest collection of vintage blooms, I think, in the country, but if not in the country, at least in the South. There's like 40 varieties of daffodils that predate the Civil War. There's peonies and hostas, which, side note, hostas are one of my favorite plants. So, yeah, when I heard that, I didn't remember that from when I visited, but also when I was 16, I didn't give a shit about plants. Priorities change. There is still surviving slave quarters on the property as well. and they are in surprisingly decent condition considering they're over 200 years old. And contrary to the Grand Manor, they would have been built far less sturdily. So the fact that they even still exist, I think, is a testament to the craftsmanship. These slaves that were doing this construction, these were very skilled artisans. And it's a shame that they weren't treated, and often still aren't treated as such. The back porch is, as I said, beautiful. The floorboards, I believe, are painted white, while the ceiling over both the bottom story and second story of the covered porch are painted a light shade of blue. And this color is often referred to as haint blue or haunt blue. And Southern folklore states that spirits cannot traverse water. So people would paint the entranceways of their homes this light blue color, so to trick the spirit to think that they can't cross the threshold. Oftentimes you see the ceilings of covered porches painted blue. Sometimes you even see the exterior frames of doors and windows painted blue as well. Shutters, even the actual building itself may have been painted blue. Who knows? Not Carnton Plantation, but like just in general, people kind of went ham with this blue color to keep the spirits out the house.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So Randall died in 1943. He left the property to his son, John McGavick. In 1848, John married his cousin, Carrie Winder, of Ducrow Plantation in Thibodeau, Louisiana.
He's the cousin fucker.
You know what? You gotta keep it. When you are a very wealthy white family, you don't let that money leave the family.
That's true.
Very sad to think, but like even the royal families all over the world do the same thing. Marry their cousins. The current furnishings inside the home are in the Greek Revival style, which you can attribute to John and Carrie. After they married, they began the process of renovating the home. The two-story portico out front, as well as the columns on the back porch, were also updated to match the Greek Revival style that was more popular in the mid-19th century. John and Carrie would have 5 children together, although only 2 of them would survive into adulthood. 3 of them would pass away at very young ages. There's actually a portrait in the what would be the master bedroom of the 3 children who died young. It's kind of I remember being creeped out by it when I was there, but now that I'm a mother, I understand it, thinking about it from their cultural perspective at the time, to have your loved ones near you. The portrait is the 3 heads of the children floating in a background of blue sky and clouds. It's not like they're decapitated, it's just the painting stops around their chest area. That sounded weird when I said 3 heads. Another Southern tradition that I remember my tour guide telling us when we were walking through is that the mirrors would often be covered with veils. Superstition would state that you cover the mirrors after somebody close to you passes away so that the spirit doesn't get confused and stay. Because spirits apparently are very vain and they like to look at themselves in the mirror. So if you cover the mirrors, they can't see themselves and they will leave you.
That's crazy.
Yeah, it's kind of weird. Side note, there's another folklore tradition, not from Carnton Plantation, just something that I learned along the way. If you are worried about spirits haunting your home, you can put little mirrors around the outside of your house so that the spirits will get distracted looking at themselves and they won't come inside your house.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
Never heard of that.
Yeah. Before the start of the Civil War, it is estimated that John McGavick was worth about $339,000, which is about equivalent to ish $10 million our time money. Wait, that doesn't make sense. Before the start of the Civil War, it is estimated that John McGavick was worth about $339,000, which in today's money would be worth around about $10 million. So again, these were very wealthy people. When the war began, John was 46. He was too old to enlist, so he did what any other good, rich, southern white boy would do. He outfitted the soldiers, large groups of soldiers. I don't know what that means specifically. I would assume he purchased weapons for them, purchased clothes, shoes, food, equipment, things like that. Carey also contributed to the war effort by sewing uniforms for friends and family who would go off to fight. When the federal authorities took control over Middle Tennessee, they caught wind of the McGavick's assistance to the Southern Rebel Army, and they seized thousands of dollars worth of grain, horses, cattle, and timber from the farm, which I'm sure only served to piss them off even more and strengthen their resolve. I'm not saying that they didn't deserve it. They were technically traitors, but I'd be pretty pissed. The Battle of Franklin took place on November 30th, 1864, and it took place in a neighboring field close to Carnton Plantation. So the plantation was used as a field hospital, as many buildings were during the Civil War. If it was a building, it would be used as a field hospital. Carnton was no exception. The battle started sometime around dusk of November 30th and lasted pretty much all night long. I believe 6 Confederate generals died during this battle, this particular battle, 4 of whom would be laid out on the back porch of Carnton Plantation for a few days afterwards. The total casualties between both armies would number somewhere around 8,000. 6,000 of those would belong to the Confederate Army. So this battle was truly catastrophic for the Confederate Army. It really marks the beginning of the end for them. And the Battle of Franklin is, we say this about all battles of the Civil War, it was the bloodiest battle. The Battle of Franklin was one of the most brutal, bloodiest battles of the Civil War. I think it's like second only to Gettysburg, something like that. It was bad.
That's crazy.
After the Battle of Franklin, of course, like I said, Carnton was used as a hospital. But Carey and the children stayed behind during the battle. I don't know how much time you would have had, how much notice you would have had to evacuate your home. I'm assuming you'd start seeing troops moving in and you would think, okay, something's about to go down. It's time to get out of here. Maybe you'd have a couple of days, but they stayed behind. Hattie and Winder were the two surviving children's names. Hattie was about 9 and Winder was about 6. And they would help their mom treat the wounded and dying. They would follow her around and assist her. It is reported that the bottom of her skirt was soaked in blood. She was actually there hands-on treating the wounded. She wasn't just allowing them in her home. She was actually hands-on treating them. One of the upstairs bedrooms, which would have been, we believe it was the nursery and the kids' room at the time. It's a southern-facing second-story bedroom with good lighting. It was used as an operating room. So when somebody would come in, they need an amputation, they'd take them up to that room, and the operating table was set up right in front of the window. On the floor, right in a pattern where it would be dripping off of a table, you can still see the bloodstains in the hardwood floors. Now, at the time, the home would have been wall-to-wall carpet. That was a very luxurious, bougie thing to do back then, to have wall-to-wall carpet. The blood soaked through the carpet and stained the hardwoods. There was that much of it. I also remember, I never read any reports of this online, but I remember our tour guard saying that they did so many amputations, they would cut off a limb and toss it out the window. The pile of limbs reached from the ground outside up to the second story window. There was that many body parts.
Damn, that's crazy.
Yeah. After the battle, the Federal Army moved on to Nashville They left their wounded and dying behind, and then later collected their dead. The Southern Army, the Confederates, were buried where they fell in the field, and simple wooden heads markers were placed over the head of each grave. After about 2 years, those markers started to deteriorate. It was very hard to read the writing that was on them. I'm not sure if they were carved or if they were painted, but whatever they did to mark who was in what grave, it was becoming very difficult to read. So the citizens of Franklin decided to raise some money and pitch in their labor, and they exhumed all of the dead soldiers and had them moved to a new cemetery that was actually donated by the McGavicks. John and Carrie set aside 2 acres of land for this cemetery. It's attached to their own private family cemetery. And what they did is they just moved all the bodies from the field into the cemetery. It is the largest privately owned military cemetery in the country. And it was the pride and joy of Carrie McGavick. She watched over that cemetery until she died. She would also wear black for the rest of her life as well, which earned her the nickname the Widow of the South. There is a New York Times bestselling book written by Robert Hicks called The Widow of the South. I've read that book too many times to count. I listened to it on audiobook. It was one of my favorite books throughout high school. It's a good book. It's a fictional story based on the actual events that transpired at Carnton. So everything in the story is not factual, but it uses the people and the events that really happened to tell a fiction story. Carrie died in 1905. After her death, their son Winder would inherit the property, and he would only live another 2 years. He died in 1907. His widow and their children moved back to Franklin. In 1909, a tornado would destroy the kitchen wing of the home. You can actually still see in the brick the discoloration from where the roof line used to meet up to the house. And after the tornado destroyed the kitchen, Winder's widow sold the property. After that, Carnton would be passed from owner to owner. By the 1960s, the home had fallen into serious disrepair. At one point, it had been used as like an apartment where a resident just lived kind of on the first floor. They didn't go upstairs. And because they lived on the first floor, they had the floors refinished, which destroyed a lot of the bloodstains that had been left behind. But because they didn't live upstairs, they left those floors untouched, which is why you can still see the bloodstains in the upstairs bedroom.
That's cool.
Yeah. In 1977, the Carnton Association was formed, and they raised money to buy, restore, and maintain the mansion. In 1978, the house and 10 acres were given to the association by Dr. and Mrs. Sugg, who had owned the property since the 1950s. The restoration was finished in the late 1990s. It is currently listed on the National Register of Historic Places. Carnton has never received any funding or support from local, state, or the federal government. It's all been funded through private organizations and nonprofits. It's currently managed by the Battle of Franklin Trust, along with another property, which I'm planning on talking about next episode. It's called the Carter House, so stay tuned for that. But yeah, that is the history of Carnton Plantation. Now for the spookity spooks.
Awesome.
Obviously, the house had, the property had slaves living on it. There was a major battle fought very near the McGavick property. And there's a lot of ghost stories centering around that. People often will hear the sounds of battle. You'll hear cannons, gunfire, yelling. You can hear wounded crying. There was one story of a gentleman who was visiting. He was a descendant of one of the people buried in the military cemetery. or in the Confederate cemetery, and he had come to visit his deceased relative, and he was walking around the grounds. He turned a corner around the house and came upon a reenactor standing with a horse, and he was like, oh, this is cool. So he starts walking a little bit closer, and he notices that the guy's kind of agitated, and as he gets closer and closer, all of a sudden the horse is gone, and he's like, what happened to this guy's horse? He turns around and there's another reenactor standing on the porch. So he asks the reenactor on the porch, where'd the guy's horse go? And the guy on the porch is like, oh, I don't know, must be dead like my horse. And he's like, oh, that's weird. But he kind of assumed that it was a bit, so he went along with it. And they started talking about what kind of guns they each had. And when the visitor told the reenactor, oh, I don't have a gun, the reenactor turned to another reenactor that was also on the porch, very concerned, and said he was worried. If we're gonna die, we might as well die like men. Took his hat off and threw it up in the air, and everyone just disappeared.
Wow, that's pretty crazy.
Yeah. The guy left and then came back the next day during the daytime. He happened to be there, I think, during dusk. And then he came back the next day during the daytime and was less creeped out. Although, I don't know if I would have had the balls to go back after an encounter like that. I might have stayed gone.
I might have gone back.
Yeah? I don't know. Also, there's lots of sightings of who people claim to be Carrie McGavick on the property. Particularly, she is seen floating through the cemetery, watching over her boys. She's often seen in a white dress, so she would be the traditional lady in white in this particular instance. You also sometimes hear stories of people catching glimpses of slaves as well on the property. There are some interesting photos. Now, I'm a really harsh critic when it comes to photographic evidence of the paranormal. I need it to be indisputable. And with technology nowadays, you can Photoshop anything. That said, there are photos of the field behind Carnton Plantation from the perspective of looking off the back porch. And you can kind of see, if you squint your eyes and zoom the picture in really tight, you can kind of see what looks like a soldier, a gray soldier, standing at the edge of the field, like in between the field and the trees, kind of in that layer of brush. And it looks like maybe he's holding a gun. I don't know.
That's crazy.
Yeah. I never had any experiences when I was at Carnton, but like I said, I'm very sensitive to energy, and that place just has that buzz, that electrified air feeling. I know that sounds weird, but that's what it feels like to me. Another place that I got that same sensation was when we were at the Alamo.
Yeah, that was pretty creepy.
Yeah, I enjoyed being at the Alamo again. Another situation where a very big event, tragic event happened. Maybe we'll talk about that when we get to Texas.
Yeah.
Although I don't know anybody who doesn't know the story of the Alamo.
It has a lot of energy there, so.
Yeah. But anyway, that is Carnton Plantation. I enjoyed researching it again. It was interesting to go back and relearn things that I had forgotten. Like I said, when I was in high school, I was obsessed with the story. Having been there, I think really influenced the fact that I was obsessed with it. I think if I'd never gone, probably wouldn't have been that big a deal. But anyway, I hope you guys enjoyed these stories. I feel like I sounded like an idiot, but that's, you know, that's just me.
Well, I liked it. And if you have any stories or requests of anything you want to hear about, or if you know anyone who does, please email us at afraidishpodcast@gmail.com, Instagram and Facebook at afraidishpodcast, and Twitter at afraid_ish. All the links will be in the show notes. And as always, don't be afraid of the dark.
Be afraid-ish
of what's in it. Bye. See you next time.
Bye.